We are Vineyard.
Hey everybody, Jay Pathak here. I'm normally your host, but this week we get to do something different. In this episode of We Are Vineyard, we hear a sermon that Rich Nathan preached at Columbus Vineyard the same week that we recorded his podcast episode back in September. It's an introduction to a series called Good Question, which explores some common questions people have about faith and Christianity. I think you're going to love it. Let's listen to Rich.
How many of you like crime shows? CSI, Law and Order, Dateline, NCIS, anybody? NCIS, yeah. NCIS has, yeah, it's an incredible franchise. NCIS LA, NCIS Hawaii. I've been writing to them. Could you do NCIS Westerville? NCIS La Vina, East Campus, something, you know? But if you're a fan of crime shows, you probably also enjoy puzzles. Maybe you enjoy crossword puzzles. But you know that the investigators in these shows, what they do is they assemble clues and they discover through their investigation who the perpetrator is. And if you watch enough crime shows, you know there are a variety of clues, clues from observation. They see, you know, was the back door jimmied or does it not appear to be a break-in? If it doesn't appear to be a break-in, it could be that the perpetrator knew the victim. There are clues from impressions, fingerprints that might be left on the murder weapon or on a doorknob or on the victim's skin. There may be impressions from tire tracks. There may be impressions from footprints. So we have clues from impressions. There's clues from blood evidence. You know, the blood that's on the knife might not be just the victims, but the perpetrators. There's clues from trace evidence, from hairs, from gun residue. I read a story, true story, about a man who was found dead on the beach, and the investigators discovered on this man's clothing were cat hairs. And they analyzed the DNA of the cat and discovered it could only have come from one cat, a cat named Tinker, who happened to be the murder suspect's cat. Which, you know, the moral of the story. Don't trust cats. Don't own a cat. They will betray you. They'll turn you in. They don't love you. They're just using you. Now, why do I get into all of this? Well, I want to talk today about a subject that's rarely covered in church. It's really assumed, but never really talked about, and that is, does the God that we pray to in church or that we pray to outside of church when we're in trouble, does that God really exist? Does the God we read about in the Bible, that we build churches to all over the world, does that God actually exist? Some of you may know that Sigmund Freud famously said that there is no God, that God is simply a product of psychological projection, that God is simply a matter of wish fulfillment. In other words, people are projecting up to the sky their father or the father they wish they had, all loving, all knowing, all powerful. There is no God. You just wish there was a God. That's what people are encountering. Now, there are lots of ways that we could, of course, respond to Sigmund Freud, but one of the simplest ways to respond to this idea that belief in God is just psychological projection is to say that just because I want something to be true doesn't mean that it's not true. In other words, If you're a high school student, or you have a child who's a high school student and they desperately want to get into their top choice of a college, just because they want to get into that top choice doesn't mean they won't. Surprise, surprise, they may actually get in. See, whether we want something to happen or not has no bearing on whether that thing will occur. I very much want my wife, Marlene, to love me. And shockingly, she tells me she does. And as a result of some hypnosis and other things, No, I'm just teasing. But really, just because we want something to be true doesn't bear on the truth or falsity of that thing. So here's what we want to talk about today. Are there clues to God's existence? Listen, today I'm not going to be talking about proofs for God's existence. When I think about proofs, I think about mathematics. And, if I could prove to you that no matter what shape triangle you showed me, that if you took out your little protractor from fifth grade and added up the degrees of each of the three angles, it will always turn out to be 180 degrees. But believing in God is not a matter of, concluding something from a set of proofs. It's really more like solving a murder case. It's more like assembling clues together so that the cumulative weight of these clues points to the fact that it's more likely than not that God exists. If you're talking with a skeptic and you want to say, look, it does make sense, a rational, reasonable person living in 2022 can actually believe that there is a God who exists, how would you communicate such a case? That's what we're going to be talking about today. I'm starting a series for our church. The series is called Good Question. And in future weeks, we're going to tackle some of the questions that people ask. For example, if God is loving, why does he seem so angry and judgmental? Don't all spiritual roads lead up the same mountain? Can you believe in both miracles and science? Isn't the Bible just a book of myths? Why does God care who I sleep with? You may want to, in this series, invite someone to church. One of these messages may be helpful for you. I hope it is, and for any of you watching online. But you may know somebody who has, a problem with faith. They just say, I just can't get past this thing in order for me to believe in God. And so this might be a great opportunity to invite someone. This is a season of invitation. We're going to be also doing Alpha groups all over the city. You've been hearing about that. You can still come to Alpha, so check that out. So as I begin today, I'm going to open in prayer because I believe God does exist and that God is a God who answers prayer. So would you just join me online, and if you're here in person, would you join me, and we're just going to pray very simply that God would be present in this talk. So Lord, I do pray. I know, Lord, that faith is a gift, and I ask you to give the gift of faith for those who struggle to believe or maybe have never believed. I ask for anyone who wherever they are with you, Lord, that they'd be able to take another step forward. Lord, you soften hearts, you draw people to yourself, and your word tells us that no one comes to you except that they be drawn. So I ask you by grace to draw. Would you now come and fill me with your spirit, put power on this message, in Jesus' name, amen. So as I told you, I'm not going to be offering you a set of proofs as if God was the conclusion of a set of mathematical propositions. Rather, I just want to offer you some clues that if we assemble the clues, it points to it's more likely than not that God does exist. And the first clue that I'd like to talk about is a clue from creation. A clue from creation. Here's what we read in Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the works of his hand. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It's like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. Now, if I was just focusing on Psalm 19 today, I would break it down for you into two parts, verses 1 through 6 and verses 7 through 12. Verses 1 through 6, God reveals himself through creation. Verses 7 to 12, God reveals himself through the Bible. Verses 1 through 6, God speaks through his works. And verses 7 to 12, God speaks through his word. For those of you who are theologically minded, verses 1 to 6 is all about God's general revelation, and verses 7 to 12 about his special revelation. But we read in verse 1 that God reveals himself in creation. And it reminds me of something that Bob Dylan said a number of years ago in one of his albums. He said, "In the fury of the moment, I can see the master's hand. In every leaf that trembles, in every grain of sand, I hear the ancient footsteps like the motion of the sea. Sometimes I turn, there's someone there. At times, it's only me. I'm hanging in the balance of a perfect finished plan, like every sparrow falling, like every grain of sand." Psalm 19, verse 1 speaks about the glory of God. The psalmist writes, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands." The idea of Psalm 19 is that it doesn't matter what your religious background is. Doesn't matter what religion you were raised in, whether you were raised with religion or not. It doesn't matter what your ethnicity is. It doesn't matter what part of the world you grew up in. It doesn't matter what your age is. It doesn't matter what your educational level is. That creation itself is speaking so that if you listen, it's a pointer to the Creator. And the way that creation speaks, or one way it speaks, is by creating awe inside the human heart. Have you ever felt awe just by looking out on something in creation where you just stood there and went, "Wow, this is unbelievable. This just fills my heart. I feel awe." Have you ever like stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon and you didn't talk? Or maybe you just stood next to Niagara Falls or at the foot of a huge mountain. Maybe you have been at the foot of Pikes Peak, or if you've been to Africa, you've visited Mount Kilimanjaro, or maybe you had the opportunity to go to Nepal and you saw the Himalayas and you felt awe. Wow. Or if you've ever been away from light pollution here in Central Ohio and you've been out in the desert, or maybe you've been out on the cruise and you're away from the light and you looked up and you could see the Milky Way and you realize, I'm looking at stars that are millions of light years away, that the light from those stars was produced millions of years ago. I don't know how many of you saw the photos that came from the James Webb telescope. Any of you see some of those photos? I mean, when I saw those photos, I just felt awe. I'm looking at pictures of the formation of stars 13 billion years ago. Like there's planets forming. There are stars dying right there. We're seeing rings around Neptune. I didn't know Neptune had rings. I don't know what you do with that all, but you know, here's what secular philosophers say. Secular philosophers, and you could just Google this, secular philosophers would say that the awe that you feel when you look out at creation, it's not pointing ahead of itself to a creator. What it's doing is, it's just electrochemical reactions in your brain. There is no such thing as awe. It's an illusion. There's no such thing as love. Google it. There's no such thing as love. Love is just an illusion. It's just electrochemical reactions in your brain designed to perpetuate the species. There's no such thing as courage. There's no such thing as self-sacrifice. It's all just designed to perpetuate the species. And yet, there's something inside the heart of most people that says, no. The entire, you know, the entirely materialistic, rationalistic worldview, the modern world, it's just too narrow. There's a fullness. There's something that's just not contained by these boundaries. Some of us have had experiences that just don't get contained by a materialistic worldview. That's a fullness. And you know, something doesn't have to be huge for us to feel awe. I remember feeling awe at the birth of my son and the birth of my daughter. When I got to hold my little baby boy and my little baby girl, I don't know if you're a parent and if you've ever had that experience. It's like, Marlene and my body produced this? You know, there's a scientific concept. It's called the fine-tuning of the universe. And the idea of the fine-tuning of the universe is that the universe is so carefully, the forces in the universe are so carefully calibrated that if you adjusted them just a little bit, the universe as we know it would not exist and we human beings would not exist. I just want to give you one example. Gravity. You know what gravity is, right? Isaac Newton, he's sitting under a tree, apple falls on his head, he says, gravity. Didn't actually happen. But in the cartoon version of Isaac Newton, that's what happened, right? So gravity functions as a kind of super glue. It holds everything together. And it's incredibly weak. Scientists tell us that if gravity was just a drop, just a smidgen weaker, everything would fly apart. There would be no stars, no planets, no you, and no me. And if gravity was just a tiny bit stronger, the universe would collapse in on itself. So how much would we adjust gravity so that either things would fly apart or just collapse in on itself? Scientists tell us if you adjusted gravity by one part in 10 to the 60th power, there would be no universe. One part in 10 to the 60th power. For those of you not great at math, what is 10 to the 60th power? It's 10 with 60 zeros following it. It's 10 trillion, 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 trillion. Like, how big is that? Well, let me bring this down a little bit. Let's say you had a dice. And I know for those of you, like, English snobs, it's called a die when it's one. So language critic, if you had a die, and you said, like, what are the chances of me rolling this dice and it will turn out to be a six? Like, what are the chances? One out of six, right? And if I rolled it twice, what are the chances of me getting two sixes in a row? Well, six times six, so one out of 36, right? And three times, six times six times six, one out of 216. Well, how many times would I have to roll the dice in order to get to 10 to the 60th power, like, you know, well, that would mean 86s in a row. 86s in a row. How long do you think you'd have to stand there and roll a dice to get 86s in the world in a row? Be like trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of years. So what the heck are you talking about, Rich? Where's this going? Okay, let me simplify this. Okay, you're in the Old West. And you're at one of those old taverns, and you know, you're sitting there with shots of rot gut, you know, whatever that is, you know, you're drinking whiskey. And some old cowboys come in and you say, "I'll bet you I can roll a six with this die." And they say, "You're on, partner." So you roll the dice, comes up six. You go, "Pay up." "All right. But we're going to bet you again you won't roll another six." You say, "You're on, double or nothing." You roll another six. They're looking at you cross-eyed. They're saying, "What's going on here?" They pay up. They go, "I'll let you win your money back. Bet I can't roll another six." They say, "Go ahead." You roll another six. How long do you think you could roll sixes before they'd shoot you through the heart? They'd say, "Wait a minute, those dice are loaded, right?" The idea is that a universe like this could not exist unless the dice were loaded, unless there was some cosmic intelligence loading the dice so that the forces that are at work could produce a universe like this. There's a cosmic intelligence. There is a God. Creation points ahead of itself to God. What are some other clues that we can assemble? They're clues from human happiness. Clues from human happiness. There's a guy who calls himself a moral psychologist. He teaches at New York University. His name is Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan Haidt, he just wrote a pretty popular book called The Coddling of the American Mind, but he wrote another book back about 15 years ago called The Happiness Hypothesis. And The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom. And in one of the really great illustrations in Jonathan Haidt's book, he compares two people. He says, first of all, I want you to consider a guy named Bob. He said, Bob is white. He's 35 years old. He lives in sunny L.A. He makes $200,000 a year. He's single. Bob is intellectual. He loves to read books. He visits museums. There's Bob. And then he says, and then there's Mary. Mary is black. She's slightly overweight. She's 65 years old. She's been married for 45 years. She lives in snowy Buffalo. And she and her husband have a combined income of $50,000. Mary spends her free time in church activities. She's deeply engaged in her church, and she's very sociable. And then what Jonathan Haidt does is he has a really surprising conclusion. He said, most people in America would rather be Bob than Mary. Mary has certainly experienced some level of discrimination over the course of her life. Yet, if you had to lay money on it, you could bet that Mary was happier than Bob. Why? Why do the social scientists tell us that Mary is happier than Bob? Well, first of all, Mary has a stable marriage. But most importantly, because Mary is a deeply religious person who believes in God and is connected to a religious community. And the social scientists tell us that people are happy not just by being attached to a community. That doesn't do it. It's a community, but you have to have faith in God. Why? Because faith in God provides a larger sense of meaning, a larger sense of purpose, a feeling that, you know, there is someone who is really overseeing things, that as I go through something, I'm not alone. Jesus said, the thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it to the full. Read the social sciences. People who have faith in God are, on average, simply happier than people who don't, as one would expect if there was a God. It's a pointer to the existence of God, that God isn't just wish fulfillment. We have a clue from creation, a clue from happiness, and a clue from our moral sensibilities, a clue from our moral sensibilities. What do I mean by that? True story, back in 2014, ISIS invaded a Kurdish village in northern Iraq. And you know ISIS, that radical Islamic group? Well, a judge that worked for ISIS took one of the women in that Kurdish village, he raped her, and he made her one of his slave wives. He had three other slave wives that he regularly beat and raped. And he believed, we've got this on record, he believed that this was in accordance with a proper interpretation of the Quran. Of course, it's a corrupt interpretation. Now, if you think that that judge was doing something immoral, that's wrong. It's not right to enslave anyone, and it's not right to rape and beat a woman. If all of us would say, yeah, that's wrong, why do you think that? There's a Duke University professor named Alex Rosenberg. He wrote a book called The Atheist Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions. And here's what he wrote. Is there a God? No. What's the nature of reality? What physics says it is. What's the purpose of the universe? There is none. What's the meaning of life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. Does prayer work? Of course not. Is there a soul? Is it immortal? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What happens when I die? Everything pretty much goes on as before, except us. What's the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. Why should I be moral? Because it makes you feel better than being immoral. Is abortion, euthanasia, suicide, paying taxes, foreign aid, or anything else you don't like forbidden, permissible, or sometimes obligatory? Anything goes. Getting back to that ISIS judge. When he took that woman and enslaved her, he was sincerely following his own religious beliefs. Now, if you disagree with what he did, and you're trying to argue with him and say, hey, what you're doing is immoral, it's wrong, the question that arises is, who says? I mean, if you don't believe in God, and if you've ever had any kind of argument with somebody who doesn't believe in God, around morality, and you have one moral view and they have another, the question always is, well, who says you're right? Who says? Who says your American view of morality, your Western view, wherever you get your morals from, who says you're right and my ISIS morality is wrong? If you think racism is wrong, that it is wrong to discriminate against someone simply on the basis of the color of their skin or their ethnicity, who says you're right, if you don't believe in God, who says you're right and this white supremacist is wrong? Who says your anti-racist views are right and KKK morality is wrong? Well, let me take an even more extreme example. If you think the Holocaust was absolutely wrong, that it is wrong to herd millions of men and women and old people and babies into gas chambers and to murder them. If you think that's wrong, and you don't believe in God, who says that your view is correct and the Nazis' view was wrong? Does our morality win just because we won the war? Does our morality win because we can line up more people who say, I agree with you, rather than the Nazis? Like, where do we get the standard from? If it's just wish fulfillment, then all we are just debating relative merits, and who says? But if you inside deeply believe, like, you don't know what you think about God, but you know that some things are wrong and some things are right, that's a pointer to the existence of God. God is not just wish fulfillment. He's speaking through our moral senses. So we have a clue from creation and a clue from human happiness and a clue from our moral sensibilities. And then there's a clue from the identity of Jesus. Now, I'm not going to spend much time here. We'll be speaking about who Jesus is in future weeks. But listen, very simply, if God, if there is a God, and God didn't just remain out up in heaven somewhere, if God didn't just remain in outer space, like on Pluto, but if at a certain moment in history, God who exists actually stepped into this world and told us what he was like in Jesus of Nazareth, that'd be a pretty big clue. Like, that'd be like, wow, okay. I mean, one of the things that is a great clue to God and God's existence is Jesus. Here's what we read in John 1, verse 18. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. And again, from the book of John, John 14, verse 9, Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been among you for such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. So Philip, and for those of you listening online or here in person, if you want to know what God is like, God revealed himself in Jesus Christ. Jesus is God with a human face. Jesus is a clue to God. So we have clues. We're putting a case together. We have clues from creation and happiness and morality and Jesus. Let me offer you one final clue regarding God's existence, and that is a clue from transformed lives. A clue from transformed lives. Listen. If there is a God and he was like the God that we read about in the Bible, then if a person encountered that God, they ought to change, right? I mean, like, if you say the stove is hot and we put our hand against the stove, it ought to leave an impression on our hand. So if you encountered God, it ought to leave an impression on your life, right? It ought to change you. I mean, you shouldn't be able to just meet God and like, eh, that was great. Thanks a lot. It should change us. Well, let me tell you a story. Back in 1976, Lebanon plunged into a civil war, and the Syrians invaded Lebanon, and they oppressed Lebanon for the next nearly 30 years. The Lebanese army came in and they pillaged, the Syrian army came in, they pillaged Lebanese villages, the Syrians raped Lebanese women, they assassinated the Lebanese prime minister, it was just dreadful living under Syrian thumb. Well, in 2005, the Syrians finally pulled out. 6 years later, Syria plunged into a civil war. And hundreds of thousands of Syrians were forced to flee Syria. Well, you know where they went? Many of them went to Lebanon. So here's the former oppressors coming to their former victims, and they're asking for help. Now the tables are turned. Well, in something that is, I think, just mind-blowing, that is so astounding, is when you read about the Lebanese church response to these Syrian refugees. And I want to read to you from one pastor. There are books written on this. But here's what one pastor wrote. When our church started assisting Syrian refugees, even Syrians were surprised. Why are you helping them? People asked. The response is this: because of the love of Christ we carry in our hearts, we assist them. We don't care what happened in the past. We tell the refugees we care about the well-being of you and your children. You are humans like we are. We must surround people with the love of Christ. Love never fails. If you love honestly, an enemy will be turned into a friend. See, I think one of the great clues to God's existence is millions of people whose lives have been changed because they met God. You understand that one of the great signs of actually encountering God in Jesus Christ is that you can love people that you don't like. The Syrians weren't just people that they didn't like. They were the enemy. And yet Jesus came in, and he enabled people, he empowered people to love. So let me ask you a question. Have you ever had an encounter with God that changed your life? Have you ever said, you know what? There's a certain kind of person that I would like to be, but I've never been able to be. Here is the promise offered to us, that if you open your heart, I mean, you really open your heart and you say, God, as much as I can, I believe you exist. And I'm not going to just play games with you, and I'm not going to if you do this, I'll do that, and make trades and bargains, but God, I'm going to throw the doors of my heart open. And I want you to come in and make me the kind of person I've always wanted to be. God will hear that prayer and he will change you.
The We Are Vineyard podcast is a production from the team at Vineyard USA. If you've been enjoying the podcast, here's a few ways you can help us. Leave us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. This helps more people find us. Connect with us online for additional resources. Our website is vineyardusa.org, and we're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at @vineyardusa. Thanks for listening. See you next week.